totally holomorphic and totally anti-holomorphic indices must vanish. And then this sort of a trace where G is the Calabi-Yau metric must also vanish. So the first two equations say that V is a holomorphic vector bundle. And the last equation there, by a theorem of Donaldson, Uhlenbeck, and Yau, is equivalent to an algebraic condition called stability, which I'll discuss later. The final condition we have to worry about is something that arises from the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation mechanism. So this implies a modified Bianchi identity for the free-form field strength. And it has an integrability condition, which looks like this. So this particular combination of the second Chern class of the manifold and those of the vector bundles gives us some cohomology class on X. And in order to have a consistent solution, we must have five brains wrapping a cycle in the corresponding Poincaré dual homology class. Now, in order for this to preserve supersymmetry, such a five-brain must be wrapped on a holomorphic curve inside X. In other words, on a Riemann surface embedded holomorphically in the Calabi-Yau. All right, and given such a background, the geometry of the manifold and the vector bundles is what determines the four-dimensional physics. So for the rest of the talk, I'll basically just focus on one of the E8 gauge groups. So I'll just talk about a single vector bundle V on which our gauge fields describe a connection with holonomy group G contained in E8. So the first thing we can ask is, what is the unbroken gauge group? That's simply the centralizer of the holonomy group of the background gauge fields. So the wave function for a massless gauge boson in the extra dimensions is just a constant. And from the Yang-Mills equations, this is only a solution if it commutes with the background gauge fields. So in particular, we can obtain just the standard model gauge group as the centralizer of SU5 times U1 inside E8. The problem is that turning on an abelian flux, turning on flux in this U1 direction, results in the corresponding gauge boson being massive. And this gauge boson being part of the photon means that's sort of ruled out. So that's the gauge group. We'll come back to how to obtain the standard model gauge group in an appropriate way shortly. So the other question we can ask is about the massless matter fields. So these turn out to be determined by the cohomology groups of V and certain associated bundles. So just as an example, if we have a vector bundle with structure group SU4, SU4 sits inside E8 in this manner. Its centralizer is spin 10, so we end up with an unbroken gauge group spin 10. Now, all the charged fields come from the 10-dimensional super Yang-Mills fields. And we have to look for zero modes of those fields. They live in the adjoint of E8. We can ask how this adjoint splits up under this maximal subgroup, and then look for harmonic forms with values in the appropriate vector bundles. So the fundamental representation of SU4 just corresponds to the bundle V itself. We can see that the 4 is paired with the 16 of spin 10. So that means that massless chiral multiplets in the 16 of spin 10 are just counted by H1 of the vector bundle V itself. Similarly, 16 bar fields come from H1 of the dual vector bundle, and so on. All right, so the particular type of solution I want to talk about is the original attempt to connect string theory to realistic particle physics. Given any Calabi-Yau threefold, we have a solution where we take the first vector bundle to just be equal to the tangent bundle of the manifold, which you always have, and take the second gauge bundle to be trivial. So if you look at the tadpole cancellation condition here, you can see that these two terms just cancel out. This term is zero, and we have the cohomology class on the right-hand side being zero. So that means that for the standard embedding, there are no five brains in the vacuum. There's no need to wrap five brains around cycles. So other features of the standard embedding, well, the holonomy group of a Calabi-Yau threefold is SU3. So this becomes the holonomy group of our gauge field as well. The result is to break E8 down to E6, so we get an E6 gauge theory in four dimensions. We can do the same trick I described on the last slide of breaking down the adjoint and looking at the corresponding matter content. And we find that chiral multiplets in the 27 representation of E6 are paired with the 3 of SU3. So they are just counted by H1 of the tangent bundle itself. By sphere duality, this is the same as H2 of the cotangent bundle, which is just one of the Hodge numbers of the manifold itself, H21 of X. Similarly, chiral multiplets in the 27 bar representation are counted by H1 of the cotangent bundle, which is just H11 of X. So these Hodge numbers, these independent Hodge numbers of the Calabi-Yau tell us the number of chiral and chiral 27s and 27 bars. So in particular, to have any hope of connecting with the real world, we want a net number of generations to be 3. So we require the difference between these two numbers to be plus or minus 3. And therefore the topological Euler number, which is given by this expression, to be plus or minus 6. Right, so that gives us an E6 gut. We know the world isn't E6 symmetrical. If E6 is relevant at all, it's only relevant at very high energies. So we have to break E6 down to something more realistic. Now, one simple way to do that, is if we have a non-trivial fundamental group for our Calabi-Yau threefold, then we have non-contractible paths around which we're free to specify the holonomy. So physically, this means we're turning on non-zero values for discrete Wilson line operators corresponding to non-contractible paths. The result is, for this to be consistent, these Wilson lines have to be given by a homomorphism from the fundamental group to E6, and then the unbroken gauge group is, once again, just the centralizer of that image. So it would be nice if we could just get straight to the standard model gauge group in this way, but it's a group theoretic result due to McInnes that you can't. You can't get all the way down to the standard model gauge group like that. But there's another option open. So assuming that H11 and H21 of the manifold are both at least 1, we have, as well as our 3 generations of chiral matter, at least 1 vector-like pair of 27 and 27 bar fields. Now, in supersymmetric theories, if you have vector-like chiral multiplets like that, there are D-flat directions in the potential along which we simultaneously give vacuum expectation values to a 27 field and a 27 bar field, or to multiple of those fields. So if these VEVs are rank 1 in flavor space, their effect in the field theory is to break E6 down to spin 10. If they're rank 2 in the flavor space, then they break E6 down to SU5, which is looking better. We can't go any further, unfortunately, or we get to something smaller than the standard model gauge group. Okay, so that's the four-dimensional sort of field theory idea. If we're looking at the top-down picture of this, well, I said that the charged matter comes from modes of the Super-Yang-Mills fields in 10D. So giving VEVs to those scalars corresponds to deforming the gauge connection in the extra dimensions. And in particular, if I'm breaking a gauge group down to spin 10, it means I'm changing my holonomy group in the extra dimensions to SU4. So I can interpret this as deforming the tangent bundle plus a trivial line bundle into some irreducible rank 4 bundle. And similarly for the SU5 case. So in order to get all the way down to the standard model gauge group exactly, actually we have to combine these two techniques. So that's what I'm going to describe in gory detail for the rest of the talk for a particular example, how to go about doing this. So just a quick overview of what the models look like. The first thing we'll do is construct the manifold we use. We'll find a simply connected Calabi-Yau manifold X tilde on which the cyclic group of order 12 acts freely, allowing us to take a quotient and obtain a manifold X with Hodge numbers 1 and 4. So the difference there is 3, giving us a 3-generation manifold. Then working on the covering space, we'll do exactly what I just described and explicitly construct deformations of the tangent bundle plus a trivial rank 2 bundle to some irreducible vector bundle, which will then, on which our gauge fields will then be a connection. Now, if while doing this, we preserve the Z12 symmetry, that allows us to still take the quotient by Z12 of the whole theory, including the gauge fields, and pass to a rank 5 bundle on the quotient space. And once we're on the quotient space, we can break the resulting SU5 gut group down to exactly the standard model gauge group by turning on Wilson lines. Okay, so there are a number of discrete parameters in this construction, and as a result, the moduli space actually breaks up into a number of distinct branches. It's 308 branches, as a matter of fact. We can calculate the spectrum on all of these branches. And at the end of the day, we find that in 8 cases, we get exactly the massless spectrum of the MSSM. I've got a parenthetical remark at the bottom here, which I can go into if people ask me about it, but I otherwise won't describe in detail. So this isn't the first time that people have found exactly the MSSM spectrum from the heterotic string. A couple of other groups have models like this. The fact that our models come directly from the standard embedding makes them slightly different. Whether it's better or worse is not really clear, I suppose, at this stage. But it does make them different. As I've already explained, it means there are no five brains in the vacuum. And also, there's no non-trivial vector bundle in the hidden sector, in that second E8. And as such, there are no hidden matter fields. There are gauge fields in the hidden sector, but no matter fields. And because the Hodge numbers of our manifold are very small, it means there are very few moduli, only five geometric moduli, which are counted by the Hodge numbers. And there are also a small number of uncharged vector bundle moduli, which I won't discuss today, but we have sort of roughly calculated those. And there's, again, only a handful of those. Okay, so before I go on to describe the details, does anyone have any questions at this stage? Okay. So the manifold itself. So remember, we're going to construct a simply connected manifold first and then later take a quotient. So the simply connected manifold X tilde can be represented in this way as a complete intersection in a product of projective spaces. So the notation here means that I have an ambient space, which is just a Cartesian product of six P1s. And then the matrix tells me about the equations I impose. So I have one equation for each column of the matrix, and the entries tell me the homogeneous multi-degree of the polynomial. So I have a polynomial trilinear in the first three P1s. I have a polynomial trilinear in the last three, and then finally a sextilinear polynomial. So if we focus on just the first of those, we have a trilinear polynomial in three P1s. You can show that this actually defines a Del Pezzo surface of degree 6. So then if we consider these two together, you can see that the equations don't break the direct product structure. And considering P1 equals P2 equals 0 gives us a fourfold, which is just a direct product of two DP6 surfaces. And then by the adjunction formula, you can check that that polynomial R then corresponds to a section of the anti-canonical bundle of that fourfold, whose vanishing therefore gives you a Calabi R threefold, which is X tilde. So actually, once you see this connection to the Del Pezzo surfaces, it lets you find a simpler description for X tilde, at least if you know a bit of toric geometry. If you don't, it won't matter too much for today. I won't really be using any details. But if you do, DP6 is a toric surface. Its fan looks like this. It corresponds to P2 blown up in 3 points. You can see that by just deleting the three dotted lines there, giving a projection to P2. Now, using the machinery of toric geometry lets us quickly calculate various quantities. In particular, the cohomology group H11 of Z is just eight-dimensional. Now, we can think of this as corresponding harmonic 1-1 forms sort of correspond to divisor classes on an algebraic variety. And this group is, in that sense, generated by the 12 toric divisors. So we get one divisor for each ray in the fan. We see we have 6 for DP6. So with two copies of DP6, we have 12 toric divisors. There's then a four-dimensional space of equivalence relations given by the lattice, leaving us with 8 divisor classes. We can then check that the Calabi L hypersurface inherits all its 1-1 forms from the ambient space, and therefore H11 of the Calabi L itself is 8. It's also easy enough to calculate the topological Euler number, which turns out to be minus 72 for the hypersurface. And therefore, because of that relation I showed you between the Euler number and the Hodge numbers, we conclude that H21 of X tilde is 44. Okay, so they're the pertinent details of X tilde. Now we want to take a quotient. It may not be obvious at first, but the fan for DP6 there has the symmetry of the hexagon realized by lattice automorphisms. So I can write down elements of SL2Z, which realize the dihedral group D6 on that fan. So when I take two copies of it, I get a symmetry group, which is D6 times D6. And then there's an additional order two element, which swaps the two factors. So overall, as well as the toric symmetry, I have this symmetry group, which is a semi-direct product of D6 times D6 with Z2. And I want to pick out an order 12 element to generate the group Z12 inside this symmetry group. So I've sort of shown it pictorially here. Here are my two hexagons with some colored arrows drawn to orient them. The element I want to pick out has the effect of exchanging the two hexagons, then rotating the first one by a sixth of a turn, and rotating the second one by a third of a turn in the other direction. So if you stare at that for a second, you'll see it is indeed order 12. And as a matter of fact, by applying G12 repeatedly, you can map any vertex here to any other vertex. So that means that the group acts transitively on the 12 vertices and therefore on the 12 toric divisors. So that'll be important in a second. All right, so that gives us an action of Z12 in the ambient space, but we want an action on the hypersurfaces. So we now have to restrict to those hypersurfaces which are invariant under the action. We can do that, and it's then necessary to check that, okay, we know the generic hypersurface X tilde is smooth. Sometimes when you impose a symmetry, that necessarily implies singularities. We can check that's not the case. The generic symmetric X tilde is also smooth. Furthermore, the group acts without fixed points on the hypersurface. So when we take the quotient, we don't obtain any orbifold singularities either. And in the course of checking these things, you find that the symmetric family has four parameters. Okay, we can then calculate the Hodge numbers of the quotient just by looking for invariant cohomology classes on the covering space. So there are various ways to find the action on the cohomology, all relatively straightforward, but I won't go into them. We can find the action on H11, and it corresponds to this Z12 representation. So my notation here is that a bold integer from 0 to 11 corresponds to a representation of Z12, in which the generator just acts by the corresponding phase. So you can think of these as Z12 charges, if you like. Now we see there's only a single trivial representation in here. I said that Z12 acts transitively on the divisor classes, so obviously the only invariant can be the sum of those 12 classes. So that gives us our one invariant here, and gives us that H11 of the quotient space is just one. The topological Euler number simply divides by the order of a freely acting group, so we can immediately see that the Euler number is -6, and therefore H21 is 4. So the Euler number being -6 implies that we have a so-called three-generation manifold. The standard embedding will give us one copy of the 27 bar of E6, and we'll have four copies of the 27. Okay, so that's the manifold. I'll now move on to the guts of the work, which is constructing the bundles. Did anyone want to comment or question me about the manifold? Okay. All right, so we're starting with the standard embedding. We're starting with the tangent bundle. So we need some very explicit description of the tangent bundle. So let me start with a simpler example, which is the tangent bundle of just projective space. So in this case, the tangent bundle fits into a short exact sequence shown here called the Euler sequence. So the way I read these anyway, so O1 here is the hyperplane line bundle on Pn. And one way to read exact sequences like this is to sort of read them backwards as a quotient. So this says that the tangent bundle of Pn is given by this sum of line bundles quotiented by a trivial line bundle which sits inside it. And this is actually fairly intuitive. So for projective space, we have our homogeneous coordinates, say Z0 through to Zn. But of course, there's a redundancy there. We have to identify them up to an overall scaling. So if we write down vector fields in terms of these homogeneous coordinates, for them to be well-defined on the quotient on Pn, they have to be invariant under this scaling. So we write down a general vector field in terms of the Zs, and you can see that's only going to be invariant if each coefficient function, B sub I, is homogeneous linear in the Zs. Now, homogeneous linear polynomials in the homogeneous coordinates are simply global sections of the hyperplane bundle O1. So this gives us n plus 1 sections of O1, corresponding to that the middle of my exact sequence there. But there's one more thing we have to take into account, which is that if I have a vector field which points along equivalence classes of this scaling relation, then obviously the flow it generates corresponds to a trivial flow on Pn. It just moves us around within the same equivalence classes, so it does nothing to Pn. So this vector field, which points along those equivalence classes, is called the Euler vector field, and we have to set it equivalent to zero to get a description of the tangent bundle. So that's the meaning of this this short exact sequence. The Euler vector field corresponds to my trivial bundle O there, and we divide out by that to get the tangent bundle. Now, one way to think of toric varieties is as generalizations of projective space. In particular, we can construct our toric fourfold Z out of homogeneous coordinates and then a family of equivalence relations. So I have 12 homogeneous coordinates, one for each ray in the fan that I showed you, one for each vertex of those two hexagons. And there are a total of 8 independent equivalence relations parameterized by a non-zero complex number there. So if we repeat the argument on the last page, write down vector fields in terms of the Zs, they have to be invariant under all 8 of these scalings now. So that gives us 8 independent Euler vector fields, one for each independent equivalence relation. And we get a short exact sequence which looks like this. So here, the D sub I are the 12 toric divisors corresponding to the vertices. So I have the sum of all of those line bundles, and I have to divide out by the 8 Euler vector fields to get the tangent bundle. All right, that's the tangent bundle of Z, but we're interested in a hypersurface in Z. Now, for any submanifold, you have a short exact sequence like this. You have the tangent bundle naturally injects into the tangent bundle of the ambient space, restricted to the manifold. And the co-kernel of that injection is then, just by definition, the normal bundle. And you can think of the map from the tangent bundle of Z to the normal bundle as being just the differential DF, where our hypersurface is given by F equals 0. So DF gives a natural normal direction at each point of the manifold, is the way to think of that. So in the case X tilde is an anticanonical hypersurface, like here, the normal bundle is then just the anticanonical bundle of Z itself. And for toric variety, that's given by this line bundle corresponding to the sum of the toric divisors. All right, so we have two short exact sequences. We have the tangent bundle of Z, given like this, and then we have the tangent bundle of X tilde related to it, given by the short exact sequence up the top. We can sort of mush those together and see that the tangent bundle of X tilde is the cohomology of this three-term complex. So I take the kernel of DF, where, now DF is naturally defined on the tangent bundle of Z up there, but it lifts to this sum of line bundles because it naturally annihilates all 8 Euler vector fields. There are generalized Euler identities which say that when you act with the Euler vector field on F, you get something proportional to F, but F just vanishes on the hypersurface itself. So DF annihilates all 8 of these and therefore lifts to a map on this rank 12 bundle. And then to get the tangent bundle of X tilde itself, we have to divide out by exactly that. Okay, so that's the tangent bundle, but that gives us an E6 theory. We've said we want a rank 5 bundle, not a rank 3 bundle. So we've got our rank 3 bundle by taking a rank 12 thing, dividing out by a rank 8 thing, and then taking the kernel of this DF, which reduces the dimension by one more, reduces the rank by one more. So instead of dividing out by 8, an 8-dimensional subbundle, we can get a 5-dimensional bundle if we just divide by a 6-dimensional subbundle. Okay, that's fairly straightforward. We just choose some 6-dimensional subbundle here by which to divide, and we get a rank 5 thing instead of a rank 3 thing. Now, it's easy enough to see that the bundle we end up getting, which I've called V sub E tilde, is given by an exact sequence like this. So the 2 Euler vector fields by which we've no longer divided are now still sitting inside V tilde. They inject in like this. And if we do divide out by them, we just get back to the tangent bundle itself. Okay, so we get an exact sequence like this. Okay, so that's a rank 5 bundle. Can we use this as our gauge bundle? Well, no, we can't, but this is where I need to go back to that discussion of stability and how we actually solve the Hermitian-Young-Mills equations. All right, so this is the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem to tell us when a solution to those equations exists. So the first thing to do is define the slope of a vector bundle. It's fairly straightforward. We just take its first Chern class, wedge it up with the Kähler form of the manifold, and integrate that to get a number, which we call the slope. And V tilde is then called stable if for every coherent subsheaf F, the slope of F is strictly smaller than the slope of V tilde. So if you don't know what a coherent sheaf is, it's basically just a holomorphic vector bundle, roughly. So this is saying for every sub-bundle, its slope has to be strictly smaller than that of V tilde. Now, in our case, we're looking at bundles with vanishing first chain class. So you immediately see that the slope is always zero. And therefore, for every sub-bundle must have strictly negative slope if V tilde is to be stable. But if I look at the rank 5 bundle that I constructed here, it has a rank 2 trivial sub-bundle. So obviously, a trivial bundle has slope 0. So it has slope equal to that of V tilde, and therefore makes it marginally unstable. So the problem is that this trivial subbundle obviously gives global sections. A trivial bundle has just a constant global section. So as long as they're there, V tilde itself will have global sections. So a necessary condition to make it stable is to ensure that we have no global sections and therefore none of these trivial subbundles. So we wanted to form away from this extension bundle, V sub E, to a more general bundle without global sections. So there's an easy way to do that. We can sort of see where the instability comes from. We originally had this map DF, and it annihilates all 8 Euler vector fields by the Euler identities. But then we've only divided out by a 6-dimensional subspace of that. So we've left 2 of these global sections intact. So all we need to do is deform this map DF to remove those 2 global sections from its kernel. So we want to deform it to a more general map whose kernel only has exactly the 6 global sections by which we divide out. All right, so the most general map phi between this sum of 12 line bundles and the line bundle on the right there is just represented by a 12-component vector, and each component is a quasi-homogeneous polynomial of the appropriate degree. In particular, it's a section of a particular line bundle. So it's easy enough, again, using toric geometry, to write down all the possible maps phi. It turns out to be a 420-dimensional space of such maps. And one thing you can check using computer algebra is that we can choose any 6-dimensional subspace we like of that 8-dimensional space of Euler vector fields and choose that to generate the kernel of phi, to generate the global sections of the kernel of phi. So we've got complete freedom there, which 6-dimensional subspace we choose. So if we do that and then define our vector bundles as the cohomology of this sequence, now with phi here instead of df, we get a bundle which has no global sections. So okay, that's a necessary condition for stability. Do we know that these bundles are actually stable though? Is that sufficient? Have we done enough? So I'm going to use a slightly cheeky argument to show that's true. We'll soon discuss taking the quotient by Z12 of the bundle, and that'll take us down to the quotient manifold, which has H11 equals 1. And in the case of a manifold with H11 equals 1, we have a very simple condition for stability. So we have this theorem due to Hopper, which, at least in a special case, reads like this. So if I have a holomorphic vector bundle with vanishing first Chern class on a Calabi-Yau which has H11 equals 1, then that bundle is stable if it has no global sections and none of its non-trivial wedge powers have global sections either. Okay, so that's something fairly easy to check. Global sections are not too hard. So as a matter of fact, we can check this upstairs on X tilde that none of these bundles have global sections. And that's enough to guarantee that they also don't have global sections downstairs. A global section on the quotient space would pull back to a global section upstairs. So in fact, this is enough. Stability of the bundle on the quotient space is all we need. So this is sufficient. But as a matter of fact, by pulling back the metric on V tilde you can see that V tilde is also stable. I have no idea what that is. Okay, there's a nice little physical interpretation of this too. So remember, I motivated this by saying that in the low energy theory, we had vector-like pairs of 27 and 27 bar fields to which it looked like we could give a VEV. I also said the massless 27 bars come from this cohomology group, H1 of the cotangent bundle. Now that's naturally isomorphic to this extension group. Now this extension group exactly parametrizes short exact sequences of this form. It parameterizes extensions of the tangent bundle by a trivial line bundle. So our massless 27 bar fields naturally correspond to extensions like this. And remember, that was exactly what this bundle was. It was an extension by a rank 2 trivial vector bundle. So passing to this extension corresponds to turning on a VEV for 2 of the 27 bar fields. But we've already said that there's a D-term potential saying we can't just turn on a VEV for 27 bar fields. If we do that, we must also turn on a VEV for corresponding 27 fields to cancel the D-term potential. So going away from this extension bundle to a more general bundle V tilde exactly corresponds to turning on that VEV for the 27 fields as well. So there's this nice sort of interplay between the stability from the mathematical point of view, the top-down point of view, and the D-term potential from the four-dimensional point of view. All right, so that's the bundles upstairs on the covering space. We now need to make sure we can actually quotient the theory by this symmetry group and obtain a sensible theory on the quotient space with only 3 generations instead of 36. Okay, so how do we do that? So we built V tilde in this way. We took the kernel of this map phi and then divided out by a 6-dimensional sub-bundle. So one way to make V tilde equivariant under the action of Z12 is to make sure that all the ingredients are. So we've already described the Z12 action. It permutes the 12 toric divisors. Remember, phi was a map between this sum of the 12 line bundles to a single line bundle here. So Z12 acts in an obvious way on both those bundles. It just permutes the 12 divisors. It therefore permutes the 12 factors of this rank 12 bundle, the 12 summands, and it also obviously preserves this line bundle. So for the kernel of phi to be equivariant, all we require is that phi commutes with this action. So that's simple enough. If you write down what that means explicitly, I said that phi was just a 12-component vector of homogeneous polynomials. This Z12 equivariance just implies that all the components are related by the Z12 action. So I can choose whatever I like for the first component of phi. But once I've chosen that component, all the others are related to it by the group action. So this reduces us from the full 420-dimensional space of maps phi by a factor of 12 down to a 35-dimensional space. Okay, so that's fine. That's still plenty to play with. Now we're dividing out the kernel of phi by this 6-dimensional subbundle, and we need to make sure that it's invariant as well, so that the quotient turns out to be. So we specified our 6-dimensional bundle by looking at the 8-dimensional bundle generated by the Euler vector fields and picking a 6-dimensional subspace of that. So for it to be consistent with Z12, it has to be an invariant subspace. So we look at the Z12 action on the space of Euler vector fields. They're just expressed in terms of the homogeneous coordinates. So we can just write down the action, diagonalize it, find these charges. And we can just pick any 6-dimensional sub-representation we like to get an invariant thing. Now, there's an important thing to check, though. Remember, we wanted the kernel of phi to have global sections which were exactly these 6 that we choose. So now that we've imposed this symmetry, we have to make sure that no matter which 6 we check, we have to make sure that whichever 6 we choose, we can find a phi which annihilates exactly those 6. And it's easy enough to... That's extraordinary.
No one is
there. Do you think it's a mouse or a rat or something? Oh, it could be, yeah, right.
There's no one in there.
Oh, well, we'll press on.
Okay.
So you can actually, again, check using computer algebra that no matter which 6 of these you choose, you can find an appropriate map phi, which annihilates exactly those 6. So that's nice. That gives us the full 8 choose 6, so 27 discrete possibilities for these vector bundles. So here you see the branching of the moduli space. We have a 420-dimensional space of maps phi upstairs. The equivariance reduces it to 35, and then that breaks up into 28 distinct branches, depending on which two representations we choose to leave out here. So in particular, at the stage of this extension bundle, the global sections of this trivial subbundle will carry a Z12 action given by whichever two representations we like out of that those eight up the top. So what does that mean? Well, a non-trivial equivariant structure on a line bundle means that if we act with the group, we don't just carry the fiber to itself, we carry the fiber to itself multiplied by some phase. Right? So then downstairs, when we go around a non-contractible path, that means there's a discrete holonomy. The fiber comes back to itself, but rotated by a phase. In other words, imposing some non-trivial equivariant structure here corresponds to a flat line bundle on the quotient space X. In physics terms, then, a connection on a flat line bundle is just a discrete Wilson line. So this corresponds to what I was discussing before, turning on discrete Wilson lines. And the notation I'll use is curly L sub N corresponding to the flat line bundle with representation N. So actually what we get downstairs is not quite what I told you at the start. It's not quite a deformation of the tangent bundle plus a trivial rank 2 bundle. It's a deformation of the tangent bundle plus a flat rank 2 bundle given by some representation of Z12 chosen from that one at the top. Okay, so you might be happy, but actually there's a little problem with that. So we said we wanted to construct SU5 bundles, bundles with structure group SU5, holonomy group SU5. But if we now look at the holonomy around one of those non-contractible paths downstairs, we have our SU3 matrix U corresponding to the tangent bundle part. And then we have these two discrete phases. So when we take the determinant, we get something which isn't necessarily one. In other words, the holonomy isn't necessarily contained in SU5. So we need to fix this up. And we can do that easily enough. We just impose an extra overall phase acting on V in order to cancel this phase in the determinant. And you get a condition like this for the extra line bundle L n tilde, which can always be solved mod 12. Okay, so there's no actual restriction coming from this, you just have to remember to do it. And it becomes important, it's not just an academic question, because when you get to calculating the cohomology and the way the group acts on it, this extra phase comes into that action. All right, so that lets us construct SU5 bundles on the quotient space, which are irreducible, break E8 down to SU5. But we now need to break that final SU5 down to the standard model gauge group with the choice of Wilson lines. So that's, again, easy enough to do. We choose a homomorphism from Z12 into SU5, such that the centralizer of the image is just the standard model gauge group. The only way to do that is to choose the image to lie in the hypercharged subgroup itself. So there are exactly 11 choices corresponding to the 11 non-trivial representations of Z12 inside that U1. Okay, fine, so that's the easy part. And then because these do break SU5, these Wilson lines, their action on the gauge degrees of freedom depends on which standard model representations you have. It doesn't respect the SU5 structure. So the 10 of SU5 breaks up into three different representations of the standard model group, and they have three different charges under this Wilson line, which will be important shortly. Okay, so that's what the bundles look like. Right, we've constructed bundles upstairs, which are a deformation of the tangent bundle plus a trivial thing to something irreducible. We've made sure that they still admit a supersymmetric connection by making sure that they're stable, and that they also still admit an action of the group Z12. So this means they pass to rank 5 bundles on the quotient space, which will therefore have 3 net generations. So the last question is there extra vector-like matter floating around which we don't want? So before I talk about that, does anyone have any questions about the construction? Okay. All right, so again, we start on the covering space. We do everything on the covering space and then take the quotient. So in the SU5 case, the number of different massless chiral multiples are counted by these cohomology groups. So it doesn't matter too much exactly what they are. And we now take the quotient by Z12. So we've ensured that our bundle is equivariant under Z12. That gives an action of the group on its cohomology and also on the cohomology of all the associated bundles. And we've also chosen non-zero Wilson lines with values in the SU5 gut group. And these act on not the internal wave functions of the fields, but on the gauge degrees of freedom of the fields. So we have this combined action of Z12, one on the cohomology classes, one on the gauge degrees of freedom. And the massless modes which descend to the quotient are those which are invariant under this combined action. And just to emphasize, because the Wilson lines break SU5, these don't necessarily fill out complete SU5 multiples. So in particular, in the MSSM, there are no states that descend from the 10 bar of SU5. So if we want the right spectrum, we need to make sure that none of these survive this quotient. So the 10 bars correspond to that particular cohomology group, H1 of V dual. So how do we calculate that? I thought I'd put in one cohomology calculation just to give a flavor of it. So just as a matter of notation, let me call the kernel of phi F. And we've said that V tilde is obtained by taking the kernel of phi and then dividing by this six-dimensional bundle. So we have a short exact sequence that looks like that. And just by definition, F fits into this short exact sequence. It's the kernel of this surjective map, phi. All right, dualize the first one to get V dual, which is the bundle we're interested in. And you find this short exact sequence. Now, we can look at the associated long exact sequence in cohomology and try to calculate the cohomology groups of V dual in terms of the cohomology groups of these guys. So we know the cohomology of the structure sheaf of a Calabi Yau. We need to calculate the cohomology of F dual. That's something you can do using the short exact sequence that defines it. And the important part is that the first two cohomology groups vanish, H0 and H1. So when I plug that result into the long exact cohomology sequence following from here, it reads in part like this. So this means that the group we're after, H1 of V dual, is just isomorphic to H0 of this trivial thing. Now I've kept the dualization operator in here, even though the dual of a trivial bundle is just itself. The reason you have to keep track of that explicitly is we also have this Z12 action. We're thinking of these things as Z12 equivariant bundles. So when we dualize, as well as dualizing the bundle, we have to dualize the Z12 action. So if the equivariant structure on this corresponded to some phase, we have to take the conjugate of that phase when we dualize it. So taking that into account, we see that the 10 bar fields, along with their Z12 charges, are given by this. We take the 6 Euler vector fields that we chose earlier, dualize their Z12 charges, and then we have to remember this extra overall phase that I discussed to twist by. Okay, so notice too that we've gone from the standard embedding, which had 8 27 bar fields, to this model, which only has 6. Again, it's easy to see why that happens from physics. We've given VEVs to 2 27 bar fields. So by the Higgs mechanism, they then get eaten by the gauge bosons, which become massive. So 2 of those 8 10 bars are eaten as part of that process, leaving us with only 6. All right, so then an explicit example of this calculation on the last page. Let me choose my 2 charges to be 3 and 4 from up there. I calculate N tilde, and then I just plug the numbers into that expression I had on the last page. So I remove 3 and 4 from that representation up the top, dualize everything, and then tensor it by 11 to find that this is the Z12 representation on my 6 copies of the 10 bar upstairs. I then choose a parameter for my Wilson lines to break SU5, and I look at the charges of the various components of the 10 bar once I've done that, and I just read them off that table from earlier. And now the massless modes on X will correspond to the combined invariants. So I take these representations, tensor them with this one, and just pick out the invariants. And you can see that there aren't any. Right? There's no 8 to pair up with this 8 dual, there's no 4, and there's no 0. So this means that none of the modes coming from the 10 bar of SU5 survive the quotient. They're all projected out of the theory. Okay, great. So no exotic states coming from the 10 bar. But does that mean, well, in the MSSM, as well as having no 10 bar fields, we have exactly three copies of the 10 of SU5. So you might think you have to calculate that separately, but luckily you don't. So there's a special case of the holomorphic Lefschetz fixed point theorem. In the case when the group acts without fixed points, it just reduces to this. And you can convince yourself fairly quickly that when you combine that with the statement of Sayre duality here, you find that as long as you ensure that there are no massless states coming from the 10 bar, you're guaranteed to get exactly three coming from the 10. Exactly three copies of the 10. So there's no need to calculate that separately. You get that for free. All right, so that's the 10. The other states in the MSSM are three copies of the 5 bar of SU5 and then a single pair of Higgs doublets, which don't fill out full SU5 representations. So we now need to crank the handle again, go back and do what turns out to be a much longer and more involved calculation, which took by far the most part of this, the time spent on this work. But in principle, there's nothing harder than anything I've showed you. And when you do that, you now when you get to the point of finding the invariant states, you want, as well as those three copies of the 5 bar, you want one extra pair of electroweak doublets to be your Higgs fields. And on those 308 branches of the moduli space that I talked about before, so the 308, actually, I don't think I mentioned. Remember I said there were 28 branches corresponding to the 8 choose 2? We then had 11 choices for the Wilson lines. So that gives you 11 times 28 independent choices, 308 independent branches of the moduli space. And on these particular 8 branches, you find that you do solve the doublet triplet splitting. You get exactly your one pair of Higgs doublets, but no associated color triplets. So you end up with just the spectrum of the MSSM. Okay, so that's about it. I've blown through that in fairly good time. So what have we done? We've gone back to the roots of heterotic string model building, looked at the standard embedding, applied some more recent techniques, and found a top-down description of how to deform these solutions to something more realistic, something with the correct gauge group. And in particular, this sort of top-down construction means you don't have to rely on effective field theory arguments for the spectrum. You can just directly calculate it as an exercise in algebraic geometry, calculating cohomology groups. Now, in contrast to the handful of existing heterotic standard models, because these are derived from the standard embedding, they require no sort of extra ingredients. There are no 5 brains in the vacuum. There's no non-trivial hidden vector bundle. So there's no hidden sector matter at all. And they also have very few moduli. But that is as far as we've gone. So this is nowhere near enough to say that we have a realistic model of particle physics. All we have is the right spectrum. So the next things, obvious things to look at are, can you make the proton live for long enough? I mean, what is the proton lifetime in this? Is baryon number conserved to an appropriate degree? Can you get a sensible looking flavor structure? In principle, it's possible to calculate the Yukawa couplings in this sort of theory. We just haven't done it yet. And of course, we need to break supersymmetry and stabilize the moduli and so on. Okay, that's all there is for now. Thanks very much.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. What do you actually do to get the Yukawas out of this?
So the Yukawas all come from the gauge couplings of the 10-dimensional Supiang-Mills theory. So it's just a direct dimensional reduction of the gauge coupling, fermion-fermion gauge boson in the 10-dimensional theory. If you sort of massage that a little bit, actually it goes back to old work of Philip partly. It boils down to, again, a calculation in cohomology. You get a trilinear pairing between the cohomology groups, which you just have to calculate.
They're all determined by what you've got.
Exactly, yeah. They're determined by the geometry of the manifold and the vector bundle. Yeah. Yeah, there's no choice involved. They can depend on the moduli. So the construction I've presented is valid throughout the complex structure moduli space. There's a four-dimensional family of these manifolds, and nothing in here really depends that sensitively on the complex structure. You get this anywhere in moduli space. So the couplings can depend on the complex structure moduli. You might want to ultimately try to stabilize the moduli in some realistic corner of that space.
At some stage in the discussion, you had, a number of families as well as antifamilies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you managed to find some appropriate geometry to... You get rid of all the antifamilies all at once, did you? Or what did you do?
So what happens is, if we look on the covering space, mm-hmm. we start with 8 antifamilies and 44 families. We do this deformation. Now, in the field theory, that corresponds to the Higgs mechanism, and in fact, a rank 2 Higgs mechanism. So, 2 antifamilies and 2 families get eaten by the Higgs mechanism, leaving you with 6 antifamilies, 42 families. But now we take the quotient by Z12 of the theory, and only the invariant states survive. And if you make appropriate choices, you can project out all the antifamilies. That's
the way
it goes.
Right, so the geometry
of
the end
is just the
3 families.
Exactly, yeah. Plus
this pair of pixels. That's what I thought. But then, at some stage, at the later stage, you were talking about how to get rid of the 10, so 10 language. How to get rid of the 5 bars, I mean, the 10 bars by themselves. It seems as if you were talking about that, and I didn't quite follow. What did you mean?
Right, so. So what I just said was, upstairs you have this Higgs mechanism and you're left with 6 antifamilies. You then look at the Z12 action on those, and it corresponds to these 6 charges. So that is the action of Z12 on those 6 cohomology groups. So as you can see, there is no invariant. They all have a non-trivial charge. So if I just take the quotient, none of them survive on the quotient space. I mean, the way to think about it is, to get the wave function on the quotient space, I look at the fibers of the projection. I have 12 points, and I...
You're getting 10 bars with some tens in extra family. Is that how they are getting...
No, so that's how 2 disappear. I mean, well, no, that's not quite true. No, so I mean, 2 get eaten by the gauge bosons. I mean, taking the quotient, all you're doing is, you're really just... by hand projecting them out of the theory. I mean, in a consistent way.
But pairing families with antifamilies, right?
No, not necessarily, no. You have an exact symmetry of your model, a Z12 symmetry, and you can take the quotient by that symmetry. So you can do this in any field.
They are never there, is that what you mean?
Exactly, they're never there on the quotient space. That's right, yeah.
To answer some of these questions at the end, I guess you need to know how to compute the higher dimension operator. Is this know how to do?
It's true, in principle you do. So there's some... I guess the short answer is no. I don't know how to compute coefficients of higher dimension operators. There's some recent work on other models where... when you have this sort of structure where we can always deform this back to a locus in the moduli space with an enhanced gauge symmetry. But at some stage here, there's been a continuous deformation to break some of the gauge symmetry. So if we go back to that locus, we have extra gauge symmetries which restrict the possible couplings, renormalizable or not. In some other cases, so this is work by Andre Lucas, James Gray, Lara Anderson, that group, they found examples where you have this enhancement of gauge symmetry, you write down all the possible operators on that locus, and then we know this deformation corresponds to giving bevs to some of those fields. And sometimes that can sort of be enough to prevent certain operators rising throughout the moduli space. Just through holomorphy, you know that they have to arise from giving bevs to fields on this locus with the enhanced symmetry. So, I mean, we haven't explored that at all, but that's something similar could well happen here because we're in a situation where we have an enhanced gauge symmetry on a particular locus in the moduli space. But yeah, in complete generality, it's very hard to calculate those higher dimension operators. You would have to make some argument like what I've just outlined.
If there are no questions, let us start this tutorial.